Welcome to On the Fly, a production of Talking Point Radio. I'm Mark Dowling, and my guest today is monologuist Mike Daisy. Join us as we discuss his latest production, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. That's Mike Daisy, coming up next on the Fly.
And there are two axes that run right through Steve Jobs' character. One is that he is passionate about design, and the other is that he is ruthless in business. And the place where these two come together the best is the breakout story. When Jobs and Wozniak are barely out of the garage, Apple's just barely starting out, Jobs goes to Wozniak and he says, "Hey, I got us a project. It's a rush job. We have to do it in 3 days. It's designing this game, Breakout, for Atari. Here's the deal. If we can make the game fit on 50 chips, then we get $700. But if we can make the game fit on 40 chips, then we get $1,000. Wozniak listens to this, and then he goes, and he drinks 3 liters of Mountain Dew. Then he just starts coding. Day and night and night and day. And 3 days later, he's done it. He goes to Jobs. And he's made the game fit on 38 chips. The people at Atari don't even understand how the fuck he did it. They're like, "What the fuck?" I don't even understand. Just ship it. I don't even fucking understand. Just ship it. It isn't until years later, when Apple is a global company and everyone involved are multi-millionaires, it isn't until then that Wozniak discovers that Jobs was paid $5,000 for that project. And further, there were no conditions from Atari about the number of chips to be used. Jobs just likes things to be efficient.
That's Mike Daisy, performing his monologue, The Agony and Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. The show, which just ended a lengthy national tour, takes its audience into the vast, depressing Chinese factories where Apple products are assembled. I spoke to Daisy at the end of his run at the Berkeley Rep.
You know, probably because I'm an investigative reporter myself, when I'm touting Mike Daisy, and I do tout Mike Daisy, I call you an investigative comedian, because it's the investigative nature of your work that is so exciting to me, and what you learned and taught us about Steve Jobs and how he works and how Apple works inside and how the production of Steve Jobs' magnificent machines in China work or don't work for the Chinese worker. Where did you develop the investigative skills, and how did you come up with the sort of expository content of your, how did that part of your content come into existence?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I grew up doing a lot of speech and debate in high school. I was very into that form, and that, I think, also reinforced the desire to create things extemporaneously in the air in front of me, but also, you know, the urge to investigate, you know, to investigate, build chains of logic and actually think through things deeply. But it's hard to say, to be honest, you know, the monologues, this monologue is the 16th one. I think one of the reasons I've made so many of them is that I'm constantly obsessed with and really engaged with a huge number of issues. And starting 6 or 7 years ago, many of the monologues began to share a very similar obsession. And the obsession is what corporatism means in our time, like what it means to be a human in an era when the corporate sphere asserts itself so fully, like what it means to be human in this age. But I think that the threading that runs through the monologues, in many cases, I had an artistic director friend of mine tell me that he thought that if there was one thing that unified all the monologues, it was often that they were the attempt to answer the question, what does it mean to live an ethical life in this age? And so I often find that many of the pieces, you know, are really me grappling with what it means to be conscious and what would it mean to be ethical, and what should our ethics be. And to be truthful, I don't know where I learned any investigative anything. I mean, I honestly, in terms of the Jobs piece and the other pieces where I just ad hoc them together from what seems appropriate. I think I'm informed by sources as varied as interviews with reporters whom I have respected, reading pieces of investigative journalism that I've found very stirring, and movies like All the President's Men. I mean, just to be quite frank, I mean, I think I just make up things as I go. And the fact that society does not consider me a journalist, a traditional one, means I have a lot less shame about making things up as I go along. The bar being, for me, the same bar I use for the monologues. You know, they're nonfiction, so I use the same resources. Would cutting this detail or that detail, would that sharpen and intensify the truthful story of what is being captured, or would it cloud and distort what story there is to tell? And so I try to use that same bar in the investigating as I do in the emotional telling of the monologue.
A lot of the reporters I worked with over the years in China who did less expository work than your monologues actually cannot go back. They can't get visas. Have you tried to go back to China since you were there?
Not yet.
It'd be interesting.
It will be, because I plan to return.
You do?
I mean, I plan to try.
Yeah.
We'll see. It'll be interesting to find out how it goes, because, of course, so much of because it's written in the air, because it's spoken in the way it is, it's so interesting the things that our culture will let you get away with if you're telling people in a room versus writing down in a magazine. So I'm curious to see if it will work or not. I hope that it does, because I would like to do more work there.
Would you say that right now Jobs is your best work?
Yeah, it might be. It might be. There's, you know, every story is different, and it's always hard to say. But it's certainly in some ways the sharpest. You know, and it is particularly wonderful to do a piece like this one, where I can full-throatedly stand behind a degree of advocacy and action. You know, because many of the monologues deal with complex ethical issues that are so large that there is no action that suggests itself. And The Last Cargo Cult, another show I was performing here, you know, is about my time on an island in the South Pacific where the people worshiped the objects of America, and was also about the international financial crisis. And so in large part, it was about the nature of capitalism as a system, and money as a system of dominance and submission. Well, you know, I did not have any action items for people at the conclusion of that monologue, because in large part, it was sort of an overview and a contextualizing of where we are. And so, to be honest, you know, like you'd finish the show every night and it'd be somewhat devastating, but you'd kind of feel, at least I often felt, people would then left like, huh, well, too bad we're embedded in that money system. I don't know what we're going to do about that. It's a relief, and it's wonderful to be working on something that's smaller, in a sense, that where instead of the entire system of money, it's actually a subset of that. And we're dealing with something that seems so large, but compared to that, it's actually quite small. It's two major superpowers of our time, their trade relationship, and the labor conditions that have been imposed relatively recently, if you look at the span of human history, in one region of that very large country. And I'm even choosing to only address, at the moment, the electronics industry within that subset. And so very direct action is called for. And so it's a delight to do a piece where you actually feel, no, change is possible. Change is very possible. There are not actually that many corporations on the ground who are engaging in these practices. We have a huge amount of influence over the corporations do who are there. If consumers and people can turn them to that end, change can be enforced relatively quickly. And so I like that. For me, that makes it stand above the others. There haven't been many where it felt like there was a direct call to action.
You're listening to monologuist Mike Daisy. Join me for the second part of our conversation, where we talk about the ephemeral nature of theater.
I like how performance, especially performance stripped away from written text, pays respect to the fact that we are going to die. I feel like it's the way art should be, that it actually travels inside of us.
That's Mike Daisy, recorded on the fly with Mark Dowie.